Well, good evening. It's great to see everybody. Welcome to our Wednesday night study. We are studying currently the book of Proverbs, and we are in chapter 3 this evening. We got about 12 verses in last week, but we're finishing up chapter 3 tonight. While you're getting there, just a quick reminder about our book of the month, 12 Extraordinary Women by John MacArthur. It's a great read, a biographical kind of book about the different women in the Bible that are highlighted, people like Ruth and Anna. There's Mary and Mary, the sisters of Lazarus. We have Sarah. There's Hannah, the Samaritan woman. There's also the mother of Jesus, Mary herself. And so a lot of women from the Bible that have some significant role or some act of faith or something that they did, and just kind of examining that and looking at that and how God used them in very extraordinary ways. So 12 Extraordinary Women. It is $12, I believe, in honor of Mother's Day this month. This is the book that we have. And speaking of Mother's Day, we're looking forward to this weekend where we get to celebrate that with all the moms. We're planning something a little bit special for Sunday morning. But that being said, looking forward to it. We also have a couple of other things just to remind everybody about. Certainly asking that everybody would be in prayer for our missions team as they're trying to raise money to go to Mexico. If you're interested in helping do that, you can go online to our website. Under our online giving, you can select that, the missions trip, as a way to do that. You can also designate in-person gifts. That's perfectly fine. Not only that, but pray. Certainly, first and foremost, pray for them. Pray that the Lord would provide all of the needs. He promised he would, so we're just praying that we would see that happen. Also, that the mission would be a success, that they would go and they would be a blessing to not just the church there, but also the community around it, and that they would get there and back safely and have fun while doing it. I think that there's this idea out there that mission trips and the Christian life have to be dull and humdrum in order to be righteous, and I think that we're called to have fun. And Paul writes about that in the book of Philippians. He says, "Complete my joy." And so I'm praying that they do have fun, they have a good time, that they're able to kind of see a different culture and how evangelism works south of the border and connect with some people that are like-minded. So it's going to be a great opportunity for everybody who goes, but we're just praying that all of those things would come together very well. So again, their mission trip is going to be in June. And speaking of June, we do have a couple of things coming up in June. We want to let everybody just put on your put in your mind. VBS is coming. That's going to start on June 21st. The 22nd. I'm sorry, that's a Monday. The 22nd is the beginning of VBS. So if you know anybody interested in signing their children up, you can go to the website and do that. But then also the week before that, I think it's June 14th is a Sunday. We just scheduled it today, so it's probably not on the website yet, but it's going to be our first baptism of the year. So if you haven't yet been baptized and you would like to, then we want to encourage you, as soon as that's available, to sign up to do it. But mark your calendars now, because on June 14th, we'll be out front here in the baptism pool. And anybody who would like to be baptized, we're certainly happy to do that with you. We want to encourage you to do that. It's one of the things Jesus commanded us to do as believers, is to be baptized. And so we offer that throughout the warmer months. If you have questions about baptism, that's not uncommon. People want to do it, but they're not really sure what it means. They're not really sure what it symbolizes or any of those other things. Let me know. We're happy to sit down and talk to you, answer all your questions about baptism, what we do here, why we do it. We will look at the Bible together and see where it comes from. And so we certainly want people to know about that, but then also to come out and be baptized on that day. Again, that's going to be June 14th. But for this evening, which is May the 6th, which is the day after May the 5th, which is the day after May the 4th be with you. Just so you know, if you like Star Wars, it was May the 4th and then the Revenge of the 5th. And I think there's a 6th or something like that. But anyway, that's the day that we're on, is May 6th. We're in Proverbs chapter 3 as we continue this study. But let's pray together. Father, we gather here today and we thank you for the chance and for the privilege of doing this. Lord, I pray that this would not be common, that just because it's a Wednesday, just because it happens every week, just because we're used to it, that it would remain special and not take the place of something that's just so familiar that It's easy to pass it off. It's easy to cast it aside as secondary because it happens always. Lord, that's the temptation. That's why your word tells us not to forsake the gathering as some are in the habit of doing. So, Lord, as we gather here tonight, and we do so for the purpose of studying your word so that we can learn more about your will for us, so that we can walk in it more closely, so that we can enjoy the blessings that you would have for us, and that we can be closer to you in fellowship. Lord, all of that is in our hearts for why we're here. And I pray that as that happens, that you would illuminate our minds and help us to understand these things. As we read this incredible part of the Bible, the book of Proverbs, and we apply it to our lives, in Jesus' name, amen. You probably remember the movies Back to the Future. And I remember the very first one that came out, and Marty McFly met up with Doc, and they went back to the future to, I think it was the 50s, but what they did was took with them an almanac that had all of the future betting and, or I'm sorry, all of the future sports records in it, and they took it back in time. And whoever had that almanac, if you remember the movie, could then place bets on future races and games, and they would clean up. And so it became this whole movie of who had that magazine, because whoever had it was going to get rich. And of course, people wanted it, and the love of money is the root of all sorts of kinds of evil. And so we see that in that movie fulfilled very well. But throughout the movie, that was the theme of just knowing the future, knowing where to place the bet, knowing what to avoid, knowing what was going to fail and what was going to succeed and when the long shot was going to come through. Wouldn't it be nice if we had an almanac like that for life, where we could read it and on page 13 or 14, it would tell us exactly what was going to happen on May 7th of 2026? And then maybe a few pages later, it would tell us who was going to be elected to the next presidential office and what was going to go on in Wall Street. And it was going to tell us what the stock market was going to do and what interest rates were going to be next year. Or maybe what jobs were going to have growth and what areas of the community was going to have increased property value. Wouldn't it be great if we had some kind of a book that would tell us the secrets of the future, that we could align our lives with that? I've often thought if Back to the Future actually happened, how much different the world would be. Well, Proverbs chapter 3 is kind of like that in a sense. It's a type of almanac if you look at it that way. It's a book of wisdom. This whole book is a book of wisdom. And in chapter 3, one of the things it's going to tell us, at least in my Bible, the heading is, "Blessed is the one who finds wisdom." Because finding wisdom is a lot like that almanac. It's kind of like the cheat code to life. If you have wisdom, then you don't necessarily need to know the answer to every individual problem. You will have a recipe for success that can be applied in a number of ways. It's kind of like cooking. You don't necessarily need to know how every single loaf of bread is made. You just need to know the basics of what goes into it. And then from those basics, you can take it and apply it and tweak it, and you can add different flavors or textures or whatever you want to do. But it comes back to that basic understanding. With life wisdom, that basic understanding allows us to then go into circumstances we've never been in and come out in a way that's very positive, very victorious. In fact, somebody once told me that was a good definition for wisdom, is knowing what to do in a circumstance you've never been in. I've never been in that before, but I tell you what, wisdom tells me that it's probably better to take this kind of course of action. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but I know this is, generally speaking, a good way of thinking. And so in chapter 3, we have this pursuit of wisdom. Now, at the very beginning of the chapter, it was all about following the guide. And you remember from last week, we talked about how God becomes our type of GPS, that he's written in his word the things that would guide our life. Well, wisdom is, do we have the wherewithal? Are we wise enough to actually follow this? Because there's incredible blessing to the one, there's blessing promised to the one who reads this and applies this to their life. And so that's what the rest of this chapter is all about the blessing in the finding of wisdom, the very thing that will help unlock secret success in life. And so with that, we begin here in verse 13.
He says, blessed is the one who finds wisdom and the one who gets understanding. Now remember who Solomon's writing to. Back in chapter 1, he was writing to a young man. It could be an actual young man. It could be writing to himself in a past tense kind of way. But he's writing to a young man, a theoretical young man, who's going out into life for the first time and wants to give him some parting words of advice, some things to live by. And so he starts talking about things like money and fidelity, and he gives us all kinds of information about avoiding sin and people who would tempt you into that kind of life. And so as he writes, he says here in verse 13, blessed is the one who finds wisdom. And so if you could go back and tell your younger self anything, what would it be? If you could travel back in time, 10 years, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, and you could have your younger version of you right there, what would you tell them? Be sure to answer that call. Don't hang out with that person. Don't go there. Don't take that job. Do take that job. Take that risk. It's going to be worth it. Because you'll find that there's incredible blessing on the other side of this kind of wisdom. And so that's essentially what Solomon is doing. He's writing to a younger version of himself. And he says, look, if there's only one thing that I could tell you, it's find wisdom. Get wisdom. Because you're not going to be able to predict every circumstance of life. But wisdom will give you a way of processing all of them. You just have to have the wisdom. You can apply it to these different circumstances, and you will be the better for it. And so blessed is the one who finds wisdom, and the one who gets understanding. He says in verse 14, for the gain from her, remember wisdom is feminine, is better than gain from silver, and her profit better than gold. You know, wealth is an interesting thing. Most people want it. The people who want it usually tell you it's not worth the trouble. I've never met a rich person with low stress, I'll put it that way. We think that it would be great to have $1 million. You know what a person with $1 million has is 1 million problems. Because the IRS knows they have $1 million. And all their friends know they have $1 million. And the family member who can't get a job knows that they have $1 million. And so they've got 1 million problems and they have no break from it at all. And so wealth is an interesting thing. It tends to be a curse more than it is a blessing. If you read the statistics, you'll find that, usually speaking, the people who win the lottery wind up broke and sometimes bankrupt within 5 to 10 years. That NFL players and other sports players that sign mega $1 million contracts, just a few years after leaving the sport, they wind up broke and in foreclosure. It seems that money is one of those things that the enemy will put in front of us as a lure to go after it rather than the things that God would have for us. As if the money is going to solve all the problems, and it seems like it will, because if, you know, the old adage is true, you throw enough money at anything, it goes away. And there's a lot of people who live their life that way, and so they're always looking for more of it, more dollars, more money, more gold, more silver, more wealth, more prestige, a higher level of class in society, a higher level of income, a higher level of adjusted gross income on their taxes. They want the bigger home, they want the faster cars, the bigger title, the bigger paycheck. And yet with it tends to come incredible stress and high blood pressure and failed marriages and all kinds of things. And so it's interesting that Solomon would point out gold and silver because he was a man that had all of it. And you remember how wealthy he was. He was the man that had more riches than anybody who had ever lived and anyone who has ever lived even to this day. And so that man who had all the gold and all the silver and all the things and all the wisdom says, look, if you can have one or the other, pick the wisdom. Because gold will fulfill the person, or I should say gold will teach you how to be filled with money. Wealth will teach you the value of money. Gold and silver will teach you how to find joy in money. But it's interesting how wisdom will simply teach you to find joy. And the wisdom of God in a relationship with Jesus Christ will simply show you how to be filled without the need for gold, without the need for the money, without the silver.
I've met plenty of people who are the most joyous, most fulfilled people in life, and they are some of the most poverty-stricken people you'll ever meet. They work and live hand to mouth. It's a labor job making minimum wage, and they're the happiest, most stress-free people I've ever met. I remember hearing a missionary from Syria come and speak one time at our pastor's conference, and he said that it's ironic because in America, we're praying for the churches in places like Syria, places where there's civil war and streets are being bombed every day and women and children are being killed. And he said that the American church is praying for the church in Syria. He said, but you know, the church in Syria prays for the American church. Because he said, look, in America, you don't go to church when it rains. In America, you're surrounded with churches on every corner, and yet the rate of people not going to church, even among faithful churchgoers, seems to be going up. He says, in America, it used to be that a faithful churchgoer went 3 to 4 times a month. Now it's 2 to 3. He said, in America, where there are no problems, there is no faith. But, he said, in Syria, where they can be killed for going to church, where bombs regularly fall, he says, you can't keep people away. They'll walk for days on end to get to a single church service. And their attitude is, what more are you going to take from us? You've already taken the house, you've taken the car, you've taken the money, you've taken the food. We're all in poverty. There's not much left to take. But what you can't take is the spirit. And you can't take the faith. And he said, the only thing left they can take is this body. But if they take this body, we go to a place where all these other problems disappear. And so it's interesting how they've learned to be filled and fulfilled in life without the money, without the gold, without the silver. And yet with all of those things seems to come a detriment of faith. That's why Jesus said that it's easier, not impossible, but he said it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than a rich man to enter heaven. Not because it's wrong to be wealthy. Plenty of rich believers in the world. And I, for one, am thankful for rich, wealthy believers. I'm so glad all the money isn't in the hands of Bezos or Zuckerberg or any of these others. I'm so glad that in the kingdom there's millions too, because we need millions. But that being said, it's a very difficult thing for a wealthy person to guard their heart. Because with wealth comes this sense of independence and self-security. And with money comes a tendency to drift away from reliance on God for our daily bread, because I can look at my bank account and there's more commas in my bank account than there is in the dictionary. And because of that, I don't need to pray, because look at everything that I've got. And so it tends to be very difficult for rich people to be truly fulfilled in the Lord, which is why Solomon is saying, look, if you can choose between the one or the other, between gold and silver or wisdom, he says, take wisdom. Gold and silver will give you the illusion of being filled and fulfilled and happy, but wisdom will show you the truth of it. Wisdom will lead you to the one who provides the gold and the silver and the long life and the health and the blessing. And so he starts here in verse 14. He says, gain from wisdom, gain from her is better than gain from silver, and her profit is better than gold. He says in verse 15, she is more precious than jewels. And nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand, and her left hand are riches and honor. I've never heard of anybody receiving anything but good from wisdom. Now, it doesn't mean bad things don't come to the wise, but, you know, it's interesting how the wisdom doesn't tend to bring the bad things, but rather helps us go through trouble and helps us deal with strife in our everyday living. I love that Solomon says that wisdom is more precious than the most precious thing you can imagine in this world. If you can pick it up and hold it, it's not as valuable as wisdom. If you can put it in your hand and weigh it on a scale, it will never measure in weight or worth or value to the wisdom of the Lord. And so he points that out. A long life is in her right hand. You know who lives a long life? Wise people. The people who know that, you know, I probably shouldn't do that. That doesn't look like it's healthy. I remember there used to be a lot of TV shows where people would do all kinds of foolish tricks. They would race down a hill on a bike and try to jump over trash cans with, you know, no helmet on and blindfolded. And they'd film this stuff and then they'd put it out on a TV show. And of course, they're always crashing. It's amazing how many people went and tried that stuff in real life and didn't make it home. A wise person would look at that and go, that looks dumb. It doesn't look wise to jump out of a perfectly good airplane. It doesn't look like a good way to live to go and mess with rattlesnakes and cobras. It doesn't look like a very wise thing to go and to live that kind of a lifestyle. It's amazing how wisdom becomes a sort of buffer in life against taking unnecessary risk. And so it really is true that with wisdom comes long life, because you're wise enough to avoid all the things that tend to cut it short. In her left hand are riches and honor. I never met a wise person who wasn't honorable. I never met a person filled with the wisdom of the Lord that didn't also apply that to their finances and their marriage and their job and their work ethic and to every other part of their life. My grandfather was probably one of the wisest guys that I ever met. And I'll tell you what, he wasn't just wise in life, but he applied it to his money. He applied it to the way he invested, his retirement. He applied it to just the way he lived life. He was frugal. He fixed it if it broke. He was faithful to his wife. He raised his children well. He worshiped the Lord. He worked hard. He did all of those things that God would say that we ought to do. He had the wisdom to manage his life in a way that the Bible would call wise. And you know, it's interesting because he never seemed to need. Now, he didn't have a lot all the time, but he never had lack. There was never a time where he wasn't able to provide the basics. And there was never a time where they weren't able to clothe the children or feed the children or keep up with the mortgage. They might not have always gone on great vacations, and they didn't have extra, but he had wisdom. And the wisdom saw him through difficult times. And it's interesting how wisdom will do that. Verse 17, it says, her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. Those who hold her fast are called blessed. The Lord, by his wisdom, founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. You know, it's amazing how intelligently the universe is and was designed and made. It's interesting when you consider things like how gravity works. And how on our earth, we're just big enough to have the amount of gravity that we have. But if we had less gravity than we do, then what would happen is trees would grow larger, buildings would have to be bigger. With less gravity, the density of rock would not be as strong or as durable and as effective as it is. With less gravity, the molecular bond of things like cement would not work as well as it does. And so things would have to be built bigger and taller, which would make it more susceptible to the rotation of the earth and earthquakes and other things. It's amazing how it all just goes into play. Something as simple as gravity that we don't stop and think about very often. You know, we think about things like relativity and how time works and how light works and how light speed works. And we think about other things like just the physics of something as basic as how water works in the world. You know, I read somewhere that water is one of the only, if not the only, I couldn't remember if it was the only or one of the only, but definitely at least one of the only things in the world or in the known universe that gets larger as it freezes. Most things contract when they freeze. Water expands when it freezes, and it gets lighter because of that very reason. Because water does that, or let me rephrase, if water did not do that, it's believed that life in this world would not exist because of the freezing nature of water to expand and get lighter, and here's why. Because as the top of the lake froze, for example, in the winter, that ice would have a tendency to sink, which would raise the level of the floor of the lake and the ocean and anywhere else. And as the floor raises higher, so too do the fish. And eventually the top layer freezes again and sinks and freezes again and sinks. And eventually the fish have nowhere to go. The algae has nowhere to go. All of it freezes. All of it dies. The algae, which produces the majority of the oxygen we have in the world, would not be around to produce oxygen. Our carbon dioxide levels would rise to the point that human beings couldn't exist. And so it's interesting how just that very basic property of water being the only thing that expands and gets lighter as it freezes is one of the most fundamental aspects of life here in this world. We don't stop and think about that kind of stuff very often. We don't stop and think about how the Earth's atmosphere works to not only provide us breathable air, but also to provide us shielding from the UV rays of the sun and other things that might come our way, including meteorites and little tiny pieces of debris from outer space that burn up in the atmosphere. And so we see a shooting star, but what that was is a rock burning up on its way in that might have otherwise impacted the world. We don't think about things like the scale of the moon to the Earth being fairly large. At 25% the Earth's mass, the moon has its own substantial gravity, and because of that tends to direct most major incoming rocks toward it, which is why the moon is filled with craters, every one of them an impact that otherwise would have hit the world. And so we don't think about that kind of thing. But yet God did, in his wisdom, in his understanding. He formed the earth. He established the heavens. The fact that light moves the way that it does. The fact that the universe, if you added up all the mass in the universe, did you know that there's only enough to create and produce roughly 1/8 the amount of gravity that is measured in the universe? The Bible says that God holds everything together in the palm of his hand. And when you add up all the gravity that is out there, there's not enough to hold us even together in our own bodies. And so it is by God's wisdom, it is by his understanding that he does all of these things. It's interesting, though, that an unbeliever will not see that. An unbeliever will look at all of those things and say, well, it's just a coincidence. It's only because water does that that life can exist. It's only because we happen to be relative to our sun where we are in our orbit that life can exist. It isn't that we're here so life could exist. It's that because we're here, it can exist. So an unbeliever looks at this the other way around. The problem with that is the statistical odds of all of those things happening in one place is so low that not only have scientists never again observed a replica of it in any known area studied in the heavens, but the mathematical odds of it are so low that it's virtually impossible for all of these things to come together in one specific place. And so by God's wisdom, by his understanding, he did all of these things. It says in verse 20, by his knowledge, the deeps broke open. Again, referring to Noah's flood, and the clouds dropped down the dew. Another interesting thing about water is the process of evaporation, condensation, and then precipitation. We all learned that in elementary science class, how rain is formed. But did you know that there is no more water in the world now than there was at the time of Noah's flood? That all the water that was ever going to be here was here. It's a closed system. So the water that you drink today is the same water the dinosaurs were drinking. It's the same water that they drank during the Civil War and the same water that they had back during the colonial days and during the medieval times. And as far back as anybody can ever go, it's the same water. It evaporates, it condensates, and it precipitates back to the world. It's a closed circuit. And yet it's interesting that none of that even happened before the flood of Noah. Before that happened, everything in the ground was watered by a river. You can read back in the early parts of Genesis. The only time rain ever fell, the first time, was during Noah's flood. One of the reasons nobody believed him. He said, a flood is coming. It's going to rain. And they're going, what are you talking about rain? What does that even mean? And you can just imagine the conversation. And go, well, water's going to fall from the sky. And they looked at him and go, water doesn't come from the sky. It comes from the ground. It's always come from the ground. It's in the river. It's in the streams. We see it. It doesn't come from the sky. What are you talking about from the sky? Well, it's interesting because in the very first chapter of Genesis, when God creates the heavens and the earth, it says that he separated the water below the firmament from the water above the firmament. And so most commentators will agree that that means that there was some kind of a water vapor around the earth, in the atmosphere of the earth, a very heavy, very humid kind of greenhouse effect that would have existed here in the world that produced the perfect conditions for life to exist. And when the flood of Noah came and it says that the fountains of the deep burst forth and that the heavens poured out their rain, that at that moment, that water vapor fell to the ground, and that the fountains of the great deep bursting forth would refer to the tearing apart of the continents. And it's interesting because in the South Atlantic Ocean, and actually up into the north part of the Atlantic Ocean, there is something called the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And you can look at it, and it's essentially a mountain range that most geographic people, geologists, will say is a scar from an earthquake that tore the crust of the earth apart and then came back together again, forming a mountain range. It's interesting how all of that is recorded in the book of Genesis. And so again, by his knowledge, the deep broke up, and the clouds dropped down the dew. And ever since that, by the way, there has been the process of evaporation, condensation, and precipitation. My son, he says, do not lose sight of these. Don't forget this. It's interesting. We get older, we forget these things. We go to college, and we really forget these things. We leave home, and we forget these things. He says, keep sound wisdom and discretion, and they will be life for your soul and adornment for your neck. I remember as a small child, my parents knew everything. And we have kids now that are still at the age where we like know everything. And it's kind of cool because we make half of it up and they believe us. It's like, do you know why? Well, it's because my favorite answer is it's the Coriolis effect. And they go, why is it? Oh, it's a Coriolis effect. Well, what is that? I said, well, because of the way the earth rotates, the water in the northern hemisphere rotates one way in a toilet, and the water in the southern hemisphere rotates the other way in a toilet when it flushes. And so that's the Coriolis effect. And that's the reason you can't have candy after dinner. And they go, huh? Just trust me on that. Okay. But they're young enough age. But then we have others. We have teenagers. And they're going, you don't know anything. You don't know what it's like to be a teenager. It's like, really? It was a while ago, but I kind of remember it. Oh, well, it's so much different now. You know, being a teenager, and it is different now. I don't want to minimize that. But it's interesting. We go from knowing everything to knowing nothing. And then a little bit later in life, about your early 20s, you realize your parents weren't wrong about everything. Most of it, but not everything. You go, they knew about something. Get a little bit older, and you realize, wow, they knew so much. They had so much wisdom. And we tend to have this arc in life where we drift away from them being wise, and then eventually we come right back to it. And then now I'm giving my kids the same advice that my dad gave me when I was their age, and they're looking at me with the same eyes that I looked at him with, going, you don't know what you're talking about. And I say, well, you don't have to believe me, but I promise you it's the Coriolis effect. And they go, I don't think that's right. Until they watch this, and then they'll know it's not. But it says here, do not lose sight of these. Remember the wisdom of your parents. Remember what your grandpa told you. Remember what mom said. Remember all those times they said, you know, when you get to this point in life, when you do that, when this happens, just keep this in mind. Keep sound wisdom and discretion. Knowing whether to do something is wisdom. Here's the thing, knowing when to do it is discretion. It's two sides to the same coin. I might know that I can do something, that's knowledge. Knowing that whether I should do it is wisdom, but then knowing, is this a good time? I should do it, but is this a good time? That's discretion. We deal a lot with that with our oldest. He has great questions, but at the wrong time. And he'll ask these questions, and he'll say, this isn't the time, not now, ask me later. He knows the question. He knows he should ask the question, but the discretion, the discernment isn't necessarily there yet. And so if you have both of those, you will be potent in life, knowing what to do, whether to do it, and when to do it, you will have the cheat code for all of life. And they will be life for your soul, he says. Verse 23, then you will walk on your way securely, and your foot will not stumble. You know, one of the most unsettling things in life is knowing whether or not you're going the right direction. Knowing, did I make the right decision? Is this exactly what God wanted for me? Did I discern that properly? Did I do this at the right time and in the right way, if I could go back and do this again, would I do it differently? Is this, in fact, what God has called me to do, or did I misunderstand somewhere? And it's a very unsettling thing to be questioning those things. Did he actually want me to do this, or was this in my heart? Was this my desire? Am I following the misleadings of a sinful heart, or is this the actual calling of the Lord? It can be an unsettling thing for sure, and there are some ways that we can give you, some helps to give you to discern these things, but ultimately, when you have that assurance, when you have the knowledge, when you walk on your way securely, when you go with the wisdom and the discernment of the Lord, and you know that you're going in his way, even when things go poorly, I'll tell you what, there is nothing more secure than knowing that you are right in where God has you, because it's amazing how none of this stuff even matters. I love what Paul said. He was being criticized in his ministry. And pastors are often criticized in their ministry, and so it just comes part and parcel with the position. You're very public. People want to throw darts sometimes at public figures, and so it just comes with it. And Paul was certainly no stranger to it himself, and he said one time, "It matters very little to me that I be judged by you," is what he told the people. And I can't help but think what he must have been going through when he said that. How many arrows and darts and other kinds of things were being lobbied against him. And yet, because Paul knew who he was serving, because he knew, he had the assurance that he was going the Lord's direction, because he knew he'd been called, he knew where he'd been called, he knew what he was supposed to be doing, and he was doing it the way God would have him do it, even when those things would happen. He said, you know what, it's okay. I mean, he goes, it doesn't matter nothing at all. He says, it matters a little bit. I mean, everybody wants to be liked. Nobody's immune to it 100%, but he says, it's very little. Because I have the assurance that I'm doing what God called me to do. And that doesn't just apply to when it's accepted by others. But do you know when else that will apply? Is when it becomes hard. When it costs you financially. When it means giving up another opportunity. When it means that you might be going in a direction that other people just don't understand. Or it means that life has taken you in an unusual direction. Or maybe it's gone in a complete left turn and you weren't ready for it, but you know this is where God has called you to be. It's amazing what we can just tolerate and what we can endure with that, what we're willing to sacrifice when we know this is absolutely the road that God has put me on. I remember when I was going into the ministry, the very first night, I was actually driving out to a regional office in Ohio. I was going to get credentialed into the ministry. It was after a long process of interviews and that kind of thing. And finally they said, okay, we want you to come to this office. We're going to have you sit down with a panel of people. And based on their discernment, we're going to credential you as a pastor or not. It was a church that I served for a very brief time. They required this kind of thing. And so I went out there. And I remember the trip should have only taken about 15 minutes. But when I started down the road, there was a traffic accident that delayed me 10 or 15 minutes. And then I got through the traffic accident. There was road work ahead that shut down the road completely. I had to detour. The detour was also then closed. I ended up on roads that the GPS didn't even know about. And 2 hours later, I showed up at my meeting. They were still there. I had called them ahead. I told him what was going on, and I got in there, and I said, look, I'm really sorry that this happened, but I'll tell you what, and I remember telling them, I can't wait to see what's going to happen, because for some reason, forces in this world tried to stop this with everything that could be thrown against me. I said, I ended up taking roads I'd never even heard of. I only found it by chance, because I just took a wrong turn, and I happened to be on the road I needed to be on. And so we went through the process, and I remember I was credentialed that evening. I went home, and shortly after, my wife and I decided that we would sell our house, and so we did. She quit her job, and so we went from a combined income of about $120,000 a year to a single income of $20,000 a year, living in a parsonage that had mold growing in the walls. But it's interesting how it didn't matter, because we were confident, we were united. This is where the Lord has called us. And so we went forward. It's just amazing what a person can endure. I think of our missionaries in the field who live in huts in the middle of mud villages. They don't have running water. They can't get to town except by plane. It only comes once a month. They're living on rice and beans. They're serving tribes that are going to war over who killed someone's pig. I mean, this really happens. And yet they say, but it doesn't matter because this is where God has called us. When you have the wisdom to discern God's call and you know that you're going the way that God would call you, it's amazing how you can walk on your way securely and your foot will not stumble. He says in verse 24, if you lie down, you will not be afraid. And when you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Do you ever go to bed and you lay there? Now, you were tired when you went to bed. That's why you went to bed. You lay down and all of a sudden you remember all those things from the day. I can't sleep now. Oh, I can't believe I said that. I can't believe I did that. And then all of a sudden, all of these things come back to you. Start replaying every mistake you ever made in your mind. The conversation that you had, you start going over it again. And then you look over at the clock and now it's 11:30 and then it's 12 and then it's 1 and then it's 2. And you're thinking, well, if I go to bed now, I'll get about 2 hours of sleep. And all you have done all night long is just replay all of this stuff in your mind. I think that happens to everybody, but it's interesting how it happens to people more often as there are things they are unsure of. Did I make the right decision? Oh my goodness, should I have done that? What kind of person am I? How come I'm doing that? How dangerous is that going to be? How thoughtless and reckless is that? What was I thinking? I can't say that. I can't go there. I can't quit that. I can't start that. And so with wisdom, when you're walking in the way of the Lord, when you know that you are on the path that he has for you, well, you lay down. Your sleep is sweet. You're not second-guessing everything. You're wondering what comes next. He says in verse 25, do not be afraid of sudden terror or of the ruin of the wicked when it comes, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught. You know, sudden terror, I think we all experience that. I know we all do. And that's the stuff that just comes out of nowhere. I didn't see that coming. All of a sudden it happened. Everything was going so well. Well, what are you talking about? The job is going to get lost. What are you talking about? We're broke. Oh, I felt so good, Doc. What do you mean that there's that wrong? The sudden terror, the things that make your heart start beating just like this out of nowhere. The phone rings. The mail comes, the knock at the door. Wisdom says, well, we're not afraid of that. We know it will come. Bring it on. Whatever it is, I know that God has me right where he wants me, and I know that my heart is to follow him. And I don't always get it right, but I know that's my desire is to be obedient to him, and I know he's not going to bring anything into my life that he wouldn't have. And so whatever it is, however sudden it might be, bring it on. Because whatever it is, God has seen it, he's approved it, he has a plan for it, and somehow it works together for the good. And so, because of that kind of wisdom, because of that kind of discretion, we're not afraid of sudden terror or the ruin of the wicked when it comes. You know, seeing others fail, it can make you nervous. You watch the TV and all of a sudden this bigwig got arrested for something. All of a sudden somebody got caught, all of a sudden something happens, and then all of a sudden we start wondering, oh my goodness, you know, is there anything that I should worry about? I worked with that person. I didn't know that they were doing that. Is that going to come back to me? They're related to me. They're my family. I can't imagine that this would come to me. I don't remember doing anything, but you know what? I can't be sure now because I did so many. When you're walking in the wisdom of the Lord, the buffer that it gives you tends to keep us away from the things that we would otherwise be worried of. And so it's like, all right, well, bring it on because I know what I've done. I know where I'm going. I know the direction God has called me. And so the ruin of the wicked, that doesn't make me anxious at all because I'm not partnered with the wicked. The Bible says, what fellowship does light have with darkness? He says, the Lord will be your confidence. He'll keep your foot from being caught. Do you know why your prayer works? Do you know why your faith works? I'll tell you what, it is not because who has the faith. It is not because of who is praying the prayer. It is because of in whom is the faith and to whom the prayer is prayed. The way that God is able to bless my life and your life and anyone else for that matter has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with him. It is because of his grace and his sovereignty and his mercy, because of his planning, because of his son on the cross for me, that I'm able to even stand up in the morning. It has nothing to do with me. Paul said it, for grace, by grace we have been saved through faith. Not of yourself, he said. It's a gift of God. I don't even have faith in the Lord because I chose it. Jesus said, no one comes to me unless the Father draws him. He said, you didn't choose me. I chose you out of the world. And so my faith doesn't come from me. My salvation doesn't come because I chose God. It doesn't come because I suddenly figured it out. Prayer doesn't work because I said the right words. I know a lot of people think, well, I just got to figure out how to say it the right way. That has nothing to do with saying it the right way. It is all because of him. And because of what he can do and what he's promised to do, and because he's faithful to his word and the work that he does through the application of his word and the wisdom that he puts into your heart through the work of the Spirit to then guide your steps in life through conviction and blessing and all the ways that he hedges around us as we travel through life. And so the Lord is our confidence. I'm not my confidence. The only thing I'm confident I can do is get lost. That's all I can do. If it weren't for God's guardrails in my life, I promise you, I'd be off a cliff by now. If it weren't for God's grace in my life, I promise you, I would be somewhere completely different. It is only because of his unmerited favor in my life that I'm able to even stand and sit and breathe, that I have a wife and a family and a church, and a faith, and a hope. It's nothing because of what I bring to the table. It's not because I got baptized one day. It's not because I became a member of a church. It's not because, you know, I gave enough. It's not because I served enough. It's because God said, that one is mine. And I'm going to guard him. And I'm calling him out of the world. And I want that one and all the mess that he is. I love what Billy Graham used to say. He said, you'd never go to the doctor when you're feeling well. You go with your fever. You go with the sore throat. You go with the cough. You go with the issues and the stomach ache. And so you don't go to God because everything's going well. You take with it or take with you all of your mess and all of your baggage. And you say, Lord, this is what I have to give you. It's a heap and it smells, but it's yours if you want it. And he says, I can work with that. And I'm going to do something with that. And I'm going to pull that one out of the world. And so the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught. Do not withhold good from those to whom it's due when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come again tomorrow, I will give it, when you have it with you. You know, in the book of James, he says the same thing. He says, if you, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he says, if you have the ability to help someone practically with some need that they have, and you tell them, go, I'm going to pray for you, but you don't actually give them the things needed for the body, he says, it's empty religion. It's empty, it's vanity, it's unable, it's not saving, because it's all for show. It's virtue signaling. That's what it is at its best. It's putting on a good show for people to see, but you don't really do anything about it. And so here, it's interesting how hundreds of years before James wrote, Solomon wrote the very same thing. He says, look, don't withhold it. You never know when you might not have another opportunity. Don't put off doing good. There is never a wrong time to do a good thing. It's never too late to do a good thing. It is never wrong to do a good thing. And so Solomon says, don't wait. Don't say to your neighbor, come back if you can do it now.
You never know when you might have another chance. Do not plan evil against your neighbor who dwells trustingly beside you. You know, betrayal is one of the most evil things a person can do because it takes advantage of trust, takes advantage of goodwill. It takes advantage of somebody who's emotionally vulnerable. It's a sneak attack. It's dastardly. I mean, it's one of the worst things. I mean, you think about our nation's history, and we've fought a lot of wars as a country. You know the ones that come to mind most often for people? War on Terror and World War II. Because they started by us being sneak attacked by the enemy, whether it was 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. I mean, it's just one of those things that lasts with a person. You remember that. You remember when you trusted somebody and they used it against you. You remember when you were vulnerable with somebody and they took advantage of you. You just remember these things. And so the warning is, don't be like that. Of all the things you can do to somebody, betrayal is probably one of the worst. I mean, it's one thing to slander somebody, but it's another thing to do it out of a sense of advantage, because they've lowered their guard, because they thought that you were a friend. And so he says, don't do it. Don't plan evil against your neighbor. Do not contend with a man for no reason, when he has done you no harm. You know, there's an old saying that goes, if you go looking for trouble, you're going to find it. And so Solomon says, don't go looking for trouble. Here's the unfortunate truth of life. Trouble will find you. If you're bored, just wait a little bit. It's going to happen. In the New Testament, we're told, so far as you are able, live peaceably with all. And I love the qualification that's in there. So far as you are able. Sometimes you're not able. Sometimes you're willing, but the other person isn't. Sometimes, no matter what you do, this person is coming at you. In which case, the Bible allows for self-defense, and Jesus commands it. It's okay. But we're not looking for the trouble. We didn't go out to start the fight. So far as you're able to live peaceably with all. So don't plan evil against your neighbor. Don't contend with a man for no reason. Do not envy a man of violence. And do not choose any of his ways. You know, it's a thing. I know every little boy has their favorite superhero. When I was growing up, I really liked, there was the Ninja Turtles. I remember they were the first ones. I really liked the Ninja Turtles. And I liked them because they did the cool flips and everything, and they had the cool weapons. And after the Ninja Turtles, I think it was then X-Men. And after X-Men, you know, at some point it becomes Rambo, I think, for like every young boy. But you tend to idolize these people, these warrior types, the ones that go out and fight. And that's what they do for a living. And all that they're ever doing is fighting against something. And it's interesting how a violent life tends to separate us in ways from other people that we'll never truly understand. David was a man of war. Now, he was a man after God's own heart, a righteous man, no doubt. But because of his tendencies in war, it precluded him from building a temple. Even in that very righteous warfare that he was waging, there is still a consequence to it. And the consequence is there's now a separation. David will never be known as a peaceful man. Even now, we talk about him as a warrior for God. It was his son Solomon who would go be a peaceful philosopher and build the temple and write the books. But David was a man of war. David was the one that killed his tens of thousands. David killed Goliath. I mean, one of the first stories of David is he's killing a giant. He goes off and fights the Philistines and all the others. He ends up in a civil war with his own sons. He's fighting against King Saul. He's doing all of it. But that's David's legacy, as a man of violence. And so the warning is, don't envy that. Because although that person may have been called to that, there is a cost to that kind of a life. And there is a cost of peace and harmony and tranquility that you can never get back. I have had, and I'll say the honor, and it is the honor, of speaking with a number of our military veterans who have gone to war and come home, many of whom have seen combat and come home. I spoke with one guy when I was at the Game Wardens Academy. He was one of our instructors, and he was a wonderful man. We had a lot of good talks. But he was in the Army in Iraq.
He was deployed, I think, 3 times. He was in combat. He was blown up once. He was shot. He was a man that was involved in hand-to-hand combat to the death. I mean, he's physically killed enemy combatants with his hands. He has a family and a wife, and he has children. But he tells me, and we were talking, because there's a camaraderie among law enforcement and soldiers and stuff, and so me coming from a military background and us being there at the academy and doing all that, we were starting to talk, and he says, you know, I'll never tell any of this to my wife. She'll never know this part of me, because I don't want to burden her with that. I don't want to put that on her. My daughters aren't going to hear these stories. He says, I tell them here, he says, in this context, because it applies and we can all understand. But he says, my wife, my daughters, my family, I can't share this with them. They'll never understand. And that's one of the biggest complaints that veterans coming home from combat will say is they don't talk about it because the people they're talking to just can't relate. They don't know what it's like. They don't know what it is to be under fire. They don't know what it is to be forced to do things you grew up your whole life being told was wrong. They don't know the emotional battle that creates within a person's conscience. And so they say, well, we just don't talk about it. And it's unfortunate because they need to talk about it. Everyone does. And yet it's something that I don't think anybody should ever envy. I remember talking to a World War II veteran one time. He was a veteran of the D-Day landings. He actually was on Omaha Beach, the most violent of all of them. If you ever watch the movie Saving Private Ryan, the beginning sequence is Omaha Beach. And when that movie came out, a lot of World War II vets who were there were interviewed and such. You know, what did you think of the movie? And they said, we couldn't watch it. It was so much like what we went through. We had to leave the theater. And so I talked to a guy one time. And he was there at Omaha Beach. And he said, you know, there are things that I saw that I'll just never tell anybody because no one will understand. And so it is admirable, but it is not enviable. It's not something that we would ever want for someone else. And so do not envy a man of violence. Do not choose those ways. They may come upon us. We may be foisted into those situations, but it's not something we should aspire to. For the devious person is an abomination to the Lord, but the upright are in his confidence. You know, deviousness, deception, that is the playbook of Satan. He is the father of lies. It says in John chapter 8, verse 44, that Satan is the father of lies, Jesus calls him. That he's a liar from the beginning of the world. It was a lie. The very first time we ever heard Satan speak in the Bible, he was lying to Eve. And ever since then, he's been lying, and that's all that he does. Everything that comes from him is a lie. It's a lie to suggest that God, through his word and the limits he places on life and the convictions and the way that he orders things like the world and the family and the church and society and the Ten Commandments and all the ways that he has created and developed and orchestrated things. It is a lie of the enemy to say that all of that is to keep people from enjoying themselves. And yet that is one of the most prominent lies we hear in the world. As well, I don't do that because I want to have fun. Well, you know, that's just a backwards way of thinking. I can't believe that you just don't want people to be happy, is what they will say to fundamental Christians who read the Bible and believe that it's true. They'll say, well, you know what? I've just grown beyond that, and I want to enjoy my time in the world. I don't need a bunch of rules telling me what not to do. It is a lie of the enemy. There is nothing new under the sun, and his playbook has never changed. And it is always a lie. It was the lie he told Eve. Oh no, God just doesn't want you to have that, Eve. Because he knows that in the day that you eat of it, you'll be just like him. And he wants to be selfish. That's what he told Eve. He wants to keep you down. He wants to keep you back from achieving your fullness. You can be all that you can be, Eve. Just eat from the fruit. Because God's not going to give it to you. You have to go and get it yourself. Trust in yourself. Follow your heart. Follow your dreams. When we leave and visit family, we come back into the state. The sign that welcomes everyone into Pennsylvania says, Pennsylvania, pursue your happiness. And I think, you know, it's not intended to be that way, maybe by the person who put it there, but you can see the obviousness of the spirit of the enemy in that kind of a phrase. Pursue your happiness. Pursue what makes you happy. You know, in the Old Testament, it tells us that Israel very often will do what was right in their own eyes. Evil in the sight of the Lord, it said, but right in their own eyes. Pursue your happiness. Do what you want. Live your best life now. Get yours while you can. And so that is the lie of the enemy. He is a deceiver by nature. And so the devious person is an abomination to the Lord, because the devious person is a child of the devil, because that is the way he operates. But the upright, the ones who stand up in the wake of all of that, the ones who say, you know what, I'm not going to behave that way. I'm not going to slander my neighbor. I'm not going to forsake my God. I am not going to indulge in the things that he's called me to abstain from. I'm not going to waver. I'm not going to let my foot go to the left or the right, but rather straight ahead. To the one who stands up and resists and says, it may not be popular, people might not understand, but this is the way that the Lord has called me, they are in his confidence. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the dwelling of the righteous. Toward the scorners he is scornful, but to the humble he gives favor. The wise will inherit honor, but fools get disgrace. You know, it's interesting how there's no middle ground in that. The wise get honor, the fools just get disgrace. It doesn't say the fools get a little bit of honor and a little bit of disgrace. No, it's one or the other. And it's interesting, we don't live like this in our society, but there are other cultures. I think of Japan, I think of China, I think of Korea, a lot of the Asian cultures that still live in an honor-based culture. And so it is a very real thing for there to be shame upon your family. I was actually hearing from somebody one time who was a missionary in Japan, and they said that in Japan, there is almost no crime. And it isn't because Japanese people are inherently better people. It's because there is a culture of honor in Japan that does not exist in the United States. We just don't have that hereditary kind of thing. But over there, it's a very real deal. And so, for example, if you were to leave your wallet on a bus stop bench, and you realize, you go, oh no, where did it go? I had $200 in there. If you go back to that bench, it will likely be there. And if it isn't, it's almost always going to be at the police station right across the street, because they have them on just about every corner. And they say it isn't because Japanese people aren't tempted by the money, although your money will be in the wallet and everything will be there. It's because of the honor. And in the culture there, it is a dishonorable, shameful thing to be found with something you did not purchase. And so because you didn't work for it, it's not yours. And there's a dishonor in having that. And so people don't want it. It's a curse to them. It's something that will bring shame upon their family. And that shame affects them in the community. It affects whether they can get jobs. It affects how much they're going to get paid. It can affect them getting loans at the bank. It can affect the way their children are treated in schools. It affects their social circles. It affects so much if their family is shamed. And so they say, it's just not worth it. The $200, yeah, it'd be nice to have, but it's not worth losing my job over. It's not worth all of these other things, because that shame is something that isn't easily removed. And so, too, the one who is wise, to the one who recognizes that God's path for us in life truly is the highest and best path, there is an honor in that. And it's an honor that nobody can take, but a fool gets disgrace. A fool will seek after the things of the world. A fool will be tempted. A fool will fall into some kind of deception. A fool will wind up with everything gone. The wise inherits honor, but the fool gets disgrace. And so if you could go back to your younger self, what kind of advice would you give that person so that they end up inheriting honor? What kind of wisdom? What mistakes would you not make? What choices would you make?
What chances would you take? What risks would you avoid? What things would you do different? Father, as we close out this chapter, we consider these things. Lord, the wisdom that you give. And Lord, it's a high and tall order to live up to this chapter. And honestly, none of us can do it. All of us are temptable. All of us fail. Every one of us has things that we wish we would have done differently. We don't always discern your will properly. But Lord, we know that where we fall short, that your grace is enough. As Paul prayed to remove the thorn from his flesh, and you said, no, my grace is sufficient for you. So Lord, as we travel down the road of life, would you illuminate our path in a way that makes your ways so clear that it's impossible to miss. I pray, Lord, that it would be one of those things that we come across and we know, oh yes, that's the one. That's the road I'm supposed to take. And Lord, when we realize that, as you reveal it to us, I pray that you would also give us the fortitude and the courage and the strength to travel that path. In spite of what may come our way, we would not fear the sudden terror as it comes up. We wouldn't fear the challenges or the risk or the danger or the cost, whatever it may be, because we know that ultimately, whatever the enemy is trying to lure us away with will not produce the thing it says it will, and yet there is unlimited and eternal blessing in the path that you've laid out. So, Father, I pray that we would keep these things in mind, as Solomon would encourage us to remember these, to keep these in our heart. Would you be with us, Lord, as we leave here tonight? Would you give us safe travel as we go home to our families? Would you give us your wisdom and your discernment as we pursue you in Jesus' name? Amen. Have a great rest of your evening, and we'll see you on Sunday morning for Mother's Day. Until then, God bless.